So I ended up sending one of my guys down to L.A. and exchanged the trophy, brought the trophy up, and he gave it to me, put it on my desk. I opened the lid. Sure enough, he had dents on the lip. And I walked into Phil Knight's office. Who do I see right off the bat? It's Phil Knight just making a beeline towards me.
Welcome to the Sports Business Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Berger. You can find the Sports Business Radio Podcast over 14 years, 500 episodes featuring conversations with people like Mark Cuban, David Stern, Jeannie Buss, Charles Barkley, Jack Nicklaus, and Kyrie Irving on iTunes or at sportsbusinessradio.com. We're ranked in the top 100 of the business news podcast section on iTunes. Follow us in between podcasts on Twitter at SB Radio. We've been named a top 50 follow by Forbes.com for three consecutive years, and on Instagram at Sports Business Radio. Coming up on our show this week, Mike Nakajima. He's been a friend of mine since 1995. He recently left Nike. He was there for almost 30 years. He was the director of tennis for U.S. sports marketing. He has some great stories to share about Pete Sampras, John McEnroe, Serena Williams, and Roger Federer. We'll get into the contract with Andre Agassi and when Andre left Nike for Adidas but then went back to Nike. And Maria Sharapova and her performance-enhancing drug suspension, but Nike continued to keep her on as an endorser. So enjoy this conversation with my friend, Mike Nakajima. My guest is a close friend, someone I've known for 20-plus years, Mike Nakajima. He was at Nike for 25-plus years. He worked in the tennis group. He was the director of tennis for U.S. sports marketing. Mike, it's been a long time since I've had you on Sports Business Radio. I actually haven't had you on Sports Business Radio. When you were on in 2005, I had to run to the birth of my daughter, and my then partner, Keith Foreman, interviewed you. So finally, after all these years, welcome to Sports Business Radio. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I had forgotten about the fact that Sophia was born.
Yeah.
Oh, that, my goodness. Was it 2005?
2005. It's been a long, long time. So let's get into your career, because you've had an amazing career. You were at Nike, like I said, for 25-plus years. When you were there, you signed everyone from John McEnroe and Pete Sampras and Andre Agassi. You've worked with Serena Williams, Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, Maria Sharapova. Tell our audience just a little bit about your role there at Nike Tennis.
Well, I mean, as far as John and Andre and those Pete Sampras are concerned, actually it was done by predecessor. I renewed their contract a couple different times since then, because John, as you know, I mean, he started playing in the late 70s, and Andre Agassi came in, probably early to mid 80s. Sampras came on board in 94, so, you know, I was involved a little bit with that one. But you know what, it was crazy because it was the heyday of tennis, and, you know, we were expected to be the best at every sport, right? And that's still no different at Nike after 30 years of being there. I think it was, you know, that's never changed. That has never changed and never will. I mean, Nike's a destination for best athletes, you know, and we go after the best ones. And when, like, for instance, in 94, our chairman basically told us to go get the best American tennis player. The best American tennis player happened to be the best player in the world. His name was Pete Sampras. We went after and signed Pete. And obviously, you know, he's won a few slams since then. So that was definitely a good sign for us. And then, you know, going to the future, Maria Sharapova, we signed her when she was 11 years old, and she could say six words in English. And first thing she tells me is that, "I don't like your socks." So those are four or five right there. So, you know what? We've come a long way. Serena, you know, amazing career, 23 slams. Obviously, Roger, 20. You know, Rafa's not too far behind. So we're still, I shouldn't say we, they are still doing really well, and hopefully continue to do so.
Tell us a little bit about the scouting of tennis players. Tennis is an international sport, unlike some other sports where, you know, you're really just focused on the United States. This is a sport where you're scouring the planet for the best talent. How does a company like Nike do that?
You know, I mean, it used to be a much smaller scouting team, but we expanded our network, so to speak. So, when I was there, I managed scouting for Asia, North America, and Australia. Those are the three areas where it was a hotbed. We had somebody else kind of keep an eye on Latin America, and we have somebody who keep an eye on Western Europe and somebody keep an eye on Central Eastern Europe. So, yeah, you're on the road all the time, right? So tennis is a sport where you can play year-round. And tennis is a sport that you can watch any player just about any time of the year. Of course, the main stage is where we watch some of those kids are at the Grand Slams, but you got to realize that every manufacturer is at those Grand Slams. So you got to go to some of these places where there aren't many of our competitors. And for the longest time, we had an event called the Nike Junior Tour, which we've had for about a dozen years, and it's the best 12s and under 14 and under 12 tournament in the world. And we brought the best of the best, and we got to watch them literally under our nose, so to speak, and decide, you know, which players are somebody worth signing, because that's the sweet spot for us. You know, 11, 12, 13, 14, Rafa signed with us when he was 12 years old, and he's been with us ever since. Like I said, Maria didn't go to play Nike Junior Tour, but we found her when she was 11. So we have to go young, you know, for the, you know, to fend off the competitors.
I know you can't go into specifics, even though you have left Nike, but when you're signing an elite player like a Serena or a Roger, what kind of deal do you have to give them? I'm assuming a multi-year deal. I'm assuming it's big money. I would think with some of the lesser players, you can just get away with giving them product, right?
Most of the players that we get are product only. That's really no different than NBA or NFL, right? Most of the athletes that we have, you know, we joke about, the fact that it's 20% gets 80% of the money.
Hmm.
You know, that's the 20-80 kind of a thing. But once again, you know, you want these athletes to be with you, to want to make sure that these guys love our product and they can wear the product. And we, to some of the top players, we cater our product to make sure that it fits them. It's a custom-made product for some of the top athletes. And we, as manufacturers, would always want a longer-term contract. The agent and the athlete potentially want a shorter-term contract, especially a young athlete coming up. We want to make sure that they're with us for a long time, but they want to make sure they have for a short amount of time. So when it's 2 or 3 years versus a 5 years, they can renew the contract for higher numbers. We want to lock these players in. If we feel like these are players that we want to invest in, we want to make sure have them for 4 or 5 years. So then that's important to us.
So you just talked about the players being involved with their product. I've read the stories about Serena, and obviously I've talked to you about this, but it seems like they want to have a pretty big say in what their product looks like, how it performs. You know, they're in the labs with the designers, and they're talking with you guys when you were there about what that product needs to look like. It's not like just, hey, take my logo and stick it on a shoe and we'll call it good.
No, they have a lot of say, you know, especially the big four, you know, Roger, Rafa, Maria, Serena. They have a lot of say in what they wear. What they wear is a little bit different than what the rest of the group wears. So it's really down in like three tiers, right? So you got the top tiers, you got those four, and then you got the next tier down, you get something a little bit special, a little bit different, but not recreating the wheel, so to speak. You know, guys like Juan Martín Del Potro, you got Grigor Dimitrov, and you got, you know, Jeannie Bouchard, and you know, some of those athletes will get a little bit slightly altered product. In other words, it's the same shirt, but you may get in a different color or a little bit different pattern. You may have a solid colored skirt or short versus, you know, a white. They make it differentiate them a little bit different from the masses, right? Masses are the rest of the athletes that, you know, we tell them this is your outfit for this tournament. They have to wear it. So it is important. And the top athletes, we do speak with them often, you know, I would say, you know, maybe 5 or 6 times a year, and making sure that the product that we're making is something that they're going to really look forward to wearing. Because at the end of the day, they're the only one who's going to be wearing it. They have to love the stuff. And I'll be honest with you, there's been times when, you know, they haven't loved the stuff. And you know what? Sometimes it affects their play. You know, they are a bit superstitious in a sense but I think it's no different than any of us. If we love what we're wearing, we tend to be happier. You know, we tend to perform well in, you know, your work or in athletic activity and so forth. So it's no different than the athletes. You know, they have to love what they wear, and if that's the case, they tend to do a little bit better.
I want to dig in on a few topics with you. One, you know, you were close with Andre Agassi, and Andre Agassi was synonymous with Nike for many, many years. But then Andre left and went to Adidas. He's back at Nike, but I know for you personally, you have close relationships with these athletes that I've mentioned, McEnroe, Sampras, Agassi, Serena, Roger, Rafa, Maria. When Andre left for Adidas, how did that impact not only the Nike-Adidas rivalry, but your relationship with Andre?
Yeah, it is a little tough. It got a little tough. I mean, you know, without getting into too much details, Andre's been nothing but great to our company. And I feel like we've done the same thing with him, but sometimes, you know, disagreements and sometimes things don't work out the way you want it to, and it's business. Even though that it hurts, you know, at the end, he did end up coming back. And we still, you know, Nike still enjoys having him. You know, Nike tennis is really synonymous, you know, with Andre Agassi. You know, certainly without Andre and what he's done for not only what he wears on the court, but his, you know, his confidence, brash, you know, attitude, I think that really made who we are. That's really no different than John McEnroe doing the same thing. So when we did, you know, get him back, it was a happy times for Nike, even though that it was several years after he had stopped playing. But we still have a lot of history with Nike, you know, with Andre at Nike, you know, since 1985, to all the way to, you know, now, you know, we can use the history of what Andre wore for us. Whereas if he wasn't with us, we would have lost that. So, you know, for us to really talk about the future, sometimes you have to talk about the past. And that allows us to do that with Andre.
Maria Sharapova, she's gone through some controversy of her own. And, you know, I look at like Michael Vick, and Nike decided to stick with Michael Vick. Vick was on our show a few weeks ago. Maria Sharapova went through the performance-enhancing drug storyline, and Nike chose to stick with her. When you have a situation like that, Nock, and again, I know you're not at Nike anymore, but what's the conversation internally when you're deciding, do we keep this athlete aligned with our brand, or do we cut ties with them?
Well, no, I think, you know, depending on the severity of it, we just felt, you know, at the time that, you know, everybody makes mistakes, you know, and she's an important part of Nike's tennis business, and the tour is already penalizing her by not, you know, allowing her to play on the tour. So I think we felt that, hey, you know, she paid her dues. A lot of times when you take that much time off the tour, it helps, you know, helps clear your mind, and, you know, but at the same time, what makes it hard is for that athlete to come back and play at the level that you want to. You know, I'm not by all means comparing her to Tiger Woods, but he took a lot of time off because of what he's done, but also with injuries. Now he just can't get back to that level. And, you know, Maria's getting there. I think she's going to be there. I think she can win another slam, but it's going to take time. So it was a lot more than the punishment that the tour gave her. You know, she's still trying to get back into the sink, and be at the level that she's capable of. Because no one, you know, hates to lose more than Maria. And I know that this has eaten her up, but you know what? She's this close, so I think she can come back again. But, you know, Nike just felt that, hey, listen, you know, everybody deserves second chances. And it was a careless mistake, and we believe her, and, you know, she's an honest person, is, you know, and an amazing businesswoman. And like I said, we've known her for many, many years. So we decided to get her another chance.
Yeah, that's got to factor in. Like you said, when you met her, she knew five words of English. And you've seen her from the time where she was a teenager to what she is now. So I'm sure when you have a relationship like that, it certainly factors in. All right. You and I are friends. We've been in the car together. You have so many great stories, but maybe the greatest one that I've ever heard you share that I'd like you to share with our audience right now is a story about Pete Sampras and Phil Knight around Phil Knight's retirement from Nike. And I'll let you fill in the rest, but it's an amazing story. So would you share it with our audience?
I'm happy to. Now that I left Nike, I guess I can
yeah,
talk a little bit.
You can tell the truth.
No, listen, it wasn't so much that it was a lie or a truth, and like that. It was a story that was a little bit more internal struggle that I went through. As you know, every building that Nike has is named after an athlete. And rather than having a traditional ribbon cutting ceremony, we always have a big event and have the athlete there, their families there. And this is really something that Nike really cherishes, that moment. And it sits, you know, Nike has now almost 50 buildings, but at the time, you know, Pete Sampras was given a building that was named after him on the North Campus. And this is something that it was important to Pete, certainly was important to the Nike and the Nike tennis category. And this happened, I believe it was 2000. It was early 2000 is when I started talking to his agent about the event that is happening in August of 2000. And so when an athlete is given a building, in a lot of ways, it's harder to get a building named after you than maybe potentially winning Wimbledon. Wimbledon, you work hard, you have a chance. Somebody has to name a building after you. It takes a little bit more than that. So this was important to the family, it was important to everybody that was involved. So we started working early in 2000 with regards to what can Pete give back to Phil Knight, right? So Phil Knight's giving you a building, and at the ceremony, he's going to give you a big architectural rendering of the building that is signed and it's framed, and it's just a really nice piece as a keepsake that, hey, you got a building named after you. And so the expectation is now, hey, Pete needs to give something back to Phil as a thank you. We started talking. His agent suggested that they have a scroll of all the Wimbledon titles he's won up to that point. He's won six at the time, and it was a beautiful scroll with calligraphy, beautiful writing. Everybody he's beaten, the scores, and Pete would sign it, a special note to Phil. And I thought that was a perfect gift. And of course, that July, Pete wins his seventh Wimbledon. Because now I'm calling his agent back saying, you can't give him that because now it's an outdated gift. So he says, what do you want? What do you want to give him, like a nice signed racket or shoes? I said, no, listen, you know, we can give that to anyone. You know, anyone can, you know, give that to Phil. And you certainly can get that anywhere. So we couldn't think of anything. So literally 3 weeks before, I started to get a little worried because we didn't have a gift. And the whole thing just started to unravel because that's the big piece about the ceremony. We're going to put up stands right in front of the building. We're going to call it breakfast in Beaverton, just like it was breakfast at Wimbledon. A couple of British-speaking vice presidents were sitting up there and make it look like a little bit more like Wimbledon. We laid down the tennis court. It was the worst tennis court I've ever seen in my life just because it was done on cobblestones. And we were supposed to have Pat O'Brien, who way back when did some of the celebrity, some of the talk shows. So we had it all set except for the gift. And what we wanted to do is, so I said, okay, this is what we're going to do. The last trophy at Wimbledon that Pete just won, can you just bring it for event sake? Just to show that this is the present you're going to give. I'll give the trophy back to you, and we'll figure out something else to give to Phil. And we all talk about it and everything. We said, that's great. So the day of the event, of course, I pick his parents up at the airport. His dad's got a little duffel bag that he's carrying with him, and as soon as he gets off the phone, he puts his duffel bag on top of this big garbage can, unzips it, and he pulls out this beach towel, and he says, here, Mike, I don't want to carry this anymore. It's this Wimbledon trophy. And, okay, great. So I take the trophy home. I didn't want to leave it in the office in case, you know, it gets taken or whatever. And I put it on the counter, and sure enough, next morning, the next day, I find out, where is the trophy? It's not there. As it turned out, my oldest son, Andrew, at the time, he is 3 years old. He had taken off with it. He was putting candy in it. And he was running around the house with it. And I said, whoa, 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 you can't do that. So I'm getting ready to take it. And as soon as I get in the car, the top of the trophy falls off. and it's rolling down my driveway. And I get it. And I look at it. And if you look at the trophy, it's got beveled edges and this and that. And everything looks fine. But the inside lip has got a little dent on it. So now I'm in the garage trying to hammer out this, you know, little dent, you know, just, I didn't want to hit it hard because I didn't want to break it. It certainly hit a weak spot somehow that he had a dent in it.
Oh, my God.
When you put the top back on, you can't really see it. But that's fine. Everything is fine. There's 3,000 people at the event. Pete's family's there. We take a tour. Family's crying because it's so proud. Now we're doing this event, and Phil gives him the nice picture, architectural design of the building, and he says, thank you, and he says, I have something for you, Phil. So I take the trophy out of the beach towel, and I give it to Pete. Pete says, Phil, this is my gift to you. This is the trophy I just won last month at Wimbledon, my seventh Wimbledon title. Here's a trophy as my appreciation to you. And Phil gets it, starts kissing it. It's the greatest gift I've ever received in my life. And I go, that's great. That's awesome. So Phil gives me back the trophy. I wrap it up in a towel. I put it back in a bag. And everything else went great. His parents went home. I gave the trophy back. Everything went great. Perfect. Until 2 days later, I get a voicemail on my phone at work. And he says, Nakajima, Philip Knight, where's my trophy? Give me a call. And I looked at my colleagues and I said, trophy. So I immediately called the events department and I said, listen, guys, you figure this out, right? I mean, how come Phil's calling me about trophy? And they said, well, we really didn't think that was really appropriate if we took it away from him, so we didn't tell him.
Oh, God.
And I just sat there, looked in space, and I go, you got to be kidding me. So then, I'm starting to panic a little bit. 2 days later, I get another voicemail. Nakajima, you're ducking me. Call me. So it's like now I'm figuring, like, I'm going to lose my job over this. You know, that's the first thing that's going to happen. So, of course, I call his agent, explain the situation. He says, yeah, you're kind of in a pickle. I said, yes, I am. He says, why don't you call the executive director of Wimbledon? Maybe he can help. And I really didn't know how he was going to help me, but I called him anyway. He was really sympathetic. He gets me in contact with the little old man in Wimbledon who makes every one single one of these trophies. So I call this guy up. I explain my situation. He says, no problem. I'll make you a trophy. She said, do you want your name on it? I go, no. I don't want my name on it. I want Pete's name on it. He goes, do you want all the years he's won? He goes, no, I just want the exact same one that he just got last month at Wimbledon. He says, no problem.
Minus the dents, right?
Minus the dents. He says, no problem. I'll get to you probably 5-6 months. I says, I don't have 5-6 months. I don't have 5-6 days. And I'm pleading to this guy. He said, anyway, I'll pay extra to get this done ASAP. And first of all, he's quoted me a price of £1,200. Which I thought was very inexpensive considering that was my job, but also the fact that it was a Wimbledon trophy and the fact that he was willing to make this for me, and he doesn't know me from Adam. So sure enough, I convinced him to drop everything and make this, and he promised me to get it within 2 weeks. I had to fend off Phil Knight for 2 weeks. I had to avoid cafeterias. I had to avoid walking, you know, buildings and buildings because I – sure enough, I had another building. He had probably given up on me already by then. And sure enough, in about a week and a half, I get this crate in the mail. And it's nicely wrapped. It's a wooden crate. I get it. I open up the trophy. Now I called his agent, Pete's agent, and asked, hey, listen, if Pete ever found out, or if Phil ever found out that he had a replica trophy, I think he'd be really bummed. Pete's got seven of these. Would you mind, you know, exchanging this? So he'd take this replica, even though it's an identical trophy, I'm sure Pete wouldn't mind, and Pete said it was fine. So I ended up sending one of my guys down to L.A., and exchanged the trophy, brought the trophy up, and he gave it to me, put it on my desk. I opened the lid. Sure enough, he had the dent on the lip, and I walked it to Phil Knight's office. Who do I see right off the bat? It's Phil Knight just making a beeline towards me. And he starts berating me. He's like, what did you do with my trophy? You must have taken it on a tour and blah, 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 blah. I said, listen, it doesn't matter how, but I got it. Here it is. And he starts kissing the trophy. And yeah, still the best gift I've ever received. And he walked out. That's the last I saw him for a while. And I saved my job.
Oh, my. So here's the question. What an outstanding story. But does Pete Sampras and Phil Knight know that each of them has the 7th Wimbledon championship trophy? Do they know there are duplicates?
Yeah, no, Pete knows because I had to get his okay to exchange it.
Okay.
Phil doesn't know.
He will now.
But Phil has the original. He has the original.
Okay, so Pete has the replica.
Now, also, too, you got to realize that Pete's coach passed away several years ago. And I believe Pete, you know, buried one or two of those trophies with him. And
wow.
Wimbledon was able to make him replicas of that to replace it.
Wow.
So I mean, that meant that much to him. So, I mean, they're identical trophies. They're made by the same guy. It's not like they crank them out and, you know, there's a bunch of them out there kind of a thing. They're just certainly one of a kind. But, it was interesting times.
I want to take a minute and tell you about SeatGeek. Buying tickets can be complicated and confusing, but there's a better way to buy with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to every type of live event. Whether you're searching for a last-minute deal, planning a night out with friends, or need to find the perfect gift, SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. There's nothing quite like being there in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere, and with just a few taps, I can instantly find seats. I'm going to be in San Diego coming up. I'm going to use SeatGeek to purchase tickets to go see the San Diego Padres. And I also use SeatGeek to take my daughter to concerts, and we purchase tickets using our SeatGeek app. SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. SeatGeek saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get you the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. Best of all, my listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code SBR today. That's promo code SBR, as in Sports Business Radio, for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. With Serena, I know you're close to her inner circle. I know that there's the Bean Serena doc on HBO right now. Give our audience a little insight into Serena too, because she's a pretty amazing person as well, from what you tell me.
No, she is. I mean, I think not many people get to know her, you know, and that's a little bit what was wrong with American tennis back then. Is American tennis players became huge, right? If you're moderately successful, you're huge in a sense that U.S. loves heroes, right? Americans love heroes, and not that the rest of the world don't. But she came and played her match and left, and so did Venus, and so did Andre, and so did Pete, and those guys came and left. They were really never, you know, together that much, so you never really got a chance to know them. But more times than not, you know, I've learned, you know, more and more about her. You know, I spent a lot of, you know, times in the car. One time I was at Wimbledon a couple of years ago, and we had an event way on the other side of Wimbledon. And on the way back, I had to get some certain images approved so we can post it right away. And Serena, you know, being in time in the car with Serena, I told our events group, I've got probably half an hour, 45 minutes, well, for undivided attention. Crank out some photos, send it to me. I could get it approved right on the spot. And, of course, the photos weren't coming. The photos were coming, and Serena and I were talking. And then one time she said, so, do you like shopping? I said, well, I mean, I don't like shopping, but I do it. You know, she goes, do you want to go shopping? And I said, do I want to go shopping? Like, where? He goes, let's go Central London. Oh, okay. And I'm in my mind thinking I've got more time with her to approve all these images. Sure enough, so we asked the driver to take us to Harrods, of all things, all places in Central London. And then all of a sudden she gets a phone call from so-and-so and says, yeah, I'll be there. Yeah, oh, you there too? And all of a sudden he goes, hey, sorry, before we go into Harrods, I got to meet a friend. Okay, no problem. Sure enough, you know, we get to pull up to Harrods. He goes, where are you? Oh, we're parked right behind you. Sure enough, she gets out of the car. The woman in front of her gets out of the car. Well, it wasn't just another friend. It was Kim Kardashian.
Oh, geez.
So they're in their street just talking in Central London, and it does not take more than 5 seconds before 150 people are now surrounding those two, and I completely lose her, you know, and then until she finally just ducks into the Harrods, and I follow her in, and she's asking me, you know, which, you know, high heels, which Jimmy Choo high heels I like. And like, Serena, listen, you're asking the wrong person. I don't go looking for Jimmy Choo. But she's one of those people that really, really, you know, is super kind, super, you know, conscientious of others. And, you know, when you get to know her at the time, obviously she didn't have the baby. She didn't have, you know, a husband. And oftentimes, you know, I tell her, it's like, man, you got a pretty good life. And she says, you know what? But you're married when you have kids. I go, what do you mean? Because I'm not even married, Mike. He says, I'm not married, and I want to have a family. And those are the times when you really think about, you know, all the money in the world can't buy you happiness. And, you know, it's so, I'm happy for her because she's got that now. I think now her life is complete in a sense that she's got 23 Grand Slams, right? She's got, you know, she's got an unbelievably cool husband and a beautiful little daughter. And now it's come full circle. Look at Roger. He's got two sets of twins, right? I mean, now when you have a family on top of your work and, you know, now work becomes a little bit more hobbyish because you become a full-time parent, you know, it tells you that, hey, you come full circle and you're now, for whatever, or lack of a better term, you're complete. And I'm happy for her because she's an amazing person. And when I left, I told her, you don't have to play tennis because she was taking time off awaiting the birth of her daughter. I told her, you don't have to prove to anybody. If you're going to come back to play tennis after the birth of your child, do it for yourself, not for the media, not for your sponsors, not for anybody else. Do it for you. You know, if you want to do it, then do it. You know, and she says, I want to be the best. I go, no one's going to argue that you're not the best. And she says, well, Margaret Court has 24 slams. I go, listen, Margaret Court played a million years ago when the draw was much smaller and you included amateurs. It's a little different. There's 127 other players in the field when you play. So I really, you know, feel that she's doing this a lot more for herself. She certainly wants to prove to the world that she can be number one in the world. And even though she struggled a little bit, you know, at the French, she'll be back. I mean, she's going to be playing Wimbledon and she's going to play the U.S. Open and she'll be the greatest ever. And then, you know, when she wins, you know, another one or two more slams, there'll be no argument who's the best.
I love in the Bean Serena doc that in her daughter's room, she's got the, what is it, 2017 Australian Open trophy in there because she says that we won this together because she was pregnant with her daughter when she won the Australian Open. Roger Federer is someone that you know well. You know, I've watched a lot of tennis, not nearly as much as you, but for my money, he's the greatest men's player that I've ever seen. Is there a story with Roger that stands out in your mind from all your time with him?
Well, Roger, you know, once again, when he was single, I think Roger in 94, 95. He was just coming out of juniors, really, really talented player, but super fiery, right? He'd smash rackets in a heartbeat, you know, and he wasn't the Roger Federer that we all know. And I asked Roger one day, first of all, you know, that when that changed, you know, from being a little bit of a brat on the court to, you know, that someone that everybody loves, right? There's not one person that I know that says, you know what, that Roger Federer guy, I hate the guy. No one's ever said that, you know. So, and he asked, you know, I asked him what happened, and he says, you know what, when I was just coming out to play pros, there's a guy named Murat Safin, Russian player, won Australian Open, U.S. Open, and he was one of those guys who was, that Roger was competing with in one of his final junior events. It was in the finals. It was a long-anticipated match to see who's the best junior in the world, and Roger ended up winning in three sets. He came home and watched the highlights on TV, and he said all they showed was Murat and I being bad boys on the court, yelling, screaming, smashing, throwing things. That was the highlight, not the great shots that they hit, not the fact that Roger ended up winning. That was almost took a back seat to the antics that were on the court. And Roger said it was the most embarrassing thing I've ever said, done. And he said he vowed that he would never do that again. And he hasn't since then.
Hmm.
And he says, unfortunately, my friend Murat was still doing it. He retired from tennis a few years back, but, you know, I mean, everybody can change and be better, and Roger certainly has done that. He's one of those guys, once again, when he was not, you know, married and didn't have kids and all that, he would come to our Nike house in Wimbledon. He would literally walk from the courts to our house, knock on the door. We'd all be watching TV or whatever. He goes, hey, hey, do you mind if I just come over here and make a sandwich and sit down and watch TV with you guys? I go, sure, whatever. So I say, hey, Roger, you want me to make you a sandwich? No, 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 I got this. So he just opens the fridge and just takes out all the stuff, making the sandwich. He puts it on a plate, and he sits down. And at the time, we were just watching TV on this little tiny TV. Must have been like a 12-inch screen. And because it was convenient, it was near the kitchen, we had a bigger TV on the other side. And I said, Roger, you can watch TV. He goes, no, no, no. So he would sit right next to us and watch, like, all, like eight of us watch Wimbledon highlights on this little tiny TV. And we would spend the afternoon in between his rain delays until he finds out he's got to go back. He will go back, you know. So he's never changed. You know, from back in the day when he was a great kid, when we got to know him, to now, that's never changed. When he asked, an hour out of his time, he'll give you three. You know, he can talk to a kid just as well as he can talk to an adult. You know, he knows the audience. He says all the right things. You know, he's super nice to everybody. One time he came to Nike, and he literally, he went from designs to development, and, you know, everybody's showing him how his shoes are made. And he walked out of the building, and all of a sudden he realized that he didn't thank so-and-so who was making one of his shoes. So literally ran back, all the way back into the building, all the way downstairs, just to shake the guy's hand and say thank you.
Wow.
For making my shoes. You know, you don't see that from world-class athletes. And that's why several years ago we created Roger Federer Day on Nike campus, when every building's name was changed to Roger Federer Building. And we literally made a day of it where normally when an athlete that big comes to Nike, everybody caters to him, right? Well, guess what? That day, Roger catered to us. So the very first thing we did was we wanted to show him his new TV spot. And there's like 30 of the marketing people in this one big room. They were going to debut. Roger came in with coffee and donuts for everybody, you know, pushing a cart with the coffee machine and donuts and passed out coffees to everybody. Then after that, he taught a fitness course at one of the gyms, and he was passing out RF monogram towels to every person that come out to work out in the gym. He taught a class of how he trains for tournaments. And then during lunch, what we did was he got behind the coffee bar he was a barista making coffees for everybody. When that was done, he was passing out box lunches to anybody, and he would say, hello, my name is Roger Federer, and shake everybody's hand in the cafeteria. Then he walks over to the cashier, and everybody who stood in Roger Federer's cashier line got a free lunch. And then he played Wii with, you know, Wii tennis with some of the employees. And at the end, we had a big event with Phil Knight, and we gave away two tickets for each of the four slams for the following year. And for him, it was watch me win. And that was an amazing day. And not everybody can do that. Meaning, you can't just get any athlete and put him in that same position with Roger and expect him to do well with different people. And Roger was way into it. And that's the kind of person he is. And you know what? He'll never change, and I hope he never does.
That's so awesome. What a great, great story. And you're right. There's very few athletes who could do that. We've got a few minutes left. Maybe the most bombastic athlete that sports has ever seen, and one of the early athletes that Nike signed, and someone we've had on this show, thanks to you, John McEnroe. We could probably do a whole separate podcast on just the stories you have with Mac, but is there one story that you have with Mac that you can share?
John and I, in fact, I just spoke to John yesterday in length about a project that we're doing together. But John and I, obviously, he's a fiery guy, right? So he's always a commentator for U.S. Open. And one time we were trying to create his line of product named after him. And our product guys were dragging their feet. And, of course, every time I'd see John, he'd ask me about it. I'd have to make up some kind of an excuse, say, hey, listen, they're still working on it. And they were working on it. It's just that they were just taking so long. And one time I had to ask John for a favor in New York right after a broadcast of a men's match. So we went to find him in the broadcast booth. As soon as he got out, he was in the suite. And before that, my boss at the time, her name's Sonia, and she says, hey, you know, she was in. I said, hey, Mike, where are you going? I said, oh, I need to talk to John. He goes, oh, my gosh. Can I meet John? He's one of my all-time favorites. I go, of course, come with me. You can meet John. So we go in. He had just got done a long match. You can tell he was not in that great of a mood. So, but anyway, hey, John, listen, I want you to meet someone. It's my boss, Sonia. John, oh, pleasure meeting you, blah, blah, blah. And then immediately goes on a tirade. And then John just hammers me on this and that. Where's, you know, and I didn't even get a chance to ask him the reason I was there for, and John was like screaming at me. And then afterwards, he turns around, he slams his racket on the carpet floor, and literally, the racket bounced almost eye level to me. That's how hard he slammed it. And then he went around the corner, started changing clothes, and I said, John, I'm not going to listen to this right now. I'm leaving. So we left. And then I apologized to Sonia. I said, Sonia, I'm so sorry you had to see that. And she looked at me like, are you kidding? I just got to see John at his best at your expense. Oh, my gosh, that was the best. And it's like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe you enjoyed that. It's like, I have to take that from John every other time. But the funny part is the next day, I'm walking down the stairs at the U.S. Open, and lo and behold, who comes on the other end? John. And I'm still pissed off at John for what he did yesterday. And so I wasn't even going to talk. Now I was going to walk right past him. And he goes, hey, Mike, what's going on? You guys, you doing all right? Like, we should catch over and do some dinner sometime. And I'm looking at him like, are you kidding me? You just screamed at me for I don't know how long yesterday. I had to walk out of there. I didn't even say goodbye to you. And now you're asking me, what, should we do dinner sometime? And I'm just shaking my head and go, sure, John, we'll figure it out. And he walked off. But he's one of those guys that doesn't hold a grudge. Right? He got it off his chest. He's completely fine. And hey, life goes on. So John and I are always like that. So, but you know what? We like each other enough that, hey, we're doing a little project together, like I said. And, you know, it should be good.
Yeah. Before we wrap, let's talk about some of the things you're doing now. I know you're an instructor, a teacher at the Warsaw Sports Marketing Center at the University of Oregon. I was lucky enough to be a guest speaker in your class this term. I know you're doing some consulting, and I know that you've gotten to spend more time with your family, because when you have the job as director of tennis for U.S. Sports Marketing, you're at all the Grand Slams and you miss a lot of time with your family. So how are you enjoying your career now?
I think that one of the things that, you know, when you realize you do certain things for so long is that you miss being home. You know, tennis, nothing happens in Portland, Oregon. So every time something happens in tennis, you got to get on the on a plane.
Right.
You know, at the most, you know, I was traveling probably 25 weeks out of the year. And when that happens, when you miss out on the first, you know, first steps, first words, first days of school, you can't get those days back. You know, and like I said, I did this for almost 30 years. And for me, it's just spending time with family. It's become that much more important. My oldest son just graduated from college. My middle son just graduated from high school. And then my youngest son just graduated from middle school and now high school. So life's passing me by. There wasn't a thing that I wanted to do at Nike in my group that I wanted to do it again. And, you know, I've done everything that I wanted to do. So it's time. I love a lot of the people that were at Nike. I love a lot of the athletes that I work with. But it's time. You know, you always think about what if I want to do this, I want to do that. And that never gave me an opportunity until now. So I'm enjoying spending time with family. My office is downstairs. And not to mention the fact that, you know, I don't have to travel as much. Hey, guess what? I got to go see both my boys, you know, oldest two boys graduate, which if I would have been my previous job, I would have been in Paris for the French Open. I would have missed it. So no regrets. I enjoy, you know, doing other things. And teaching was just another one of those things that I never thought I'd do because I don't have a teaching background, but I enjoyed it. I'm not sure I'll do it again because they're trying to hire a full-time instructors, and that's not what I want to do. I want to do different things, part-time, you know, for different companies, and I'm enjoying it a lot, you know. So wish me luck.
You don't need luck. You are very good at what you do, my friend, and you're terrific at building relationships. You've built great relationships with some of the top athletes in the world. I'm glad to call you a longtime friend. We met back in 1995 at the Nike Cup tennis event at what was the Rose Garden, now the Moda Center, and we've been friends ever since. So I've wanted to do this for a long time. I appreciate you sharing some great stories on our show this week, and I know that we'll catch up soon because we're both in Portland.
Oh, man. Thank you, Brian. Both Brians, thanks for having me. Enjoy the conversation. And then I'm sure I'll be hearing from some of my friends at Nike. You said what?
Well,
but hey, like I said, I don't work there anymore, right?
That's right. You got to tell some great stories today, and I appreciate you sharing those. That's Mike Nakajima. You're listening to Sports Business Radio. We'll be right back. Sports Business Radio is sponsored by Boingo Wireless, the largest operator of indoor wireless networks in the U.S. Today's sports fans expect strong, fast mobile connections at their favorite stadiums. Research shows that fans will leave at halftime if they cannot get connected, which is part of the reason why professional and collegiate sports venues alike work with Boingo to manage their wireless networks. As the world's leading connectivity expert, Boingo knows how to make a venue's vision for the connected fan experience a reality. They are the only company that can provide end-to-end wireless service so teams can focus on the big game, not on their network. Boingo designs, installs, and manages Wi-Fi and cellular networks at university stadiums like K-State and the University of Houston, and major league venues like Soldier Field, Phillips Arena, and Vivint Smart Home Arena. We're excited to showcase how technology is changing the business of sports, led by companies like Boingo. Boingo connects you to the people and things you love, like sports. For more information, visit Boingo.com or email sports@Boingo.com. Well, that's it for this edition of Sports Business Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks to our show staff, Brian Griggs and Josh Blank. Thanks to our friends at Boingo Wireless for powering our Sports Business Radio Roadshow. Follow them online at Boingo.com or on Twitter @Boingo. And thanks again to our new sponsor, SeatGeek. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code SBR, as in Sports Business Radio today. That's promo code SBR for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Thanks to our friends at MKTG. You can find them on Twitter @MKTG. Their website is MKTG.com. They're a global lifestyle marketing agency, 33 offices in 19 countries, a leading sports sponsorship and activation agency. Make sure to check them out at MKTG.com. A podcast reminder, you can catch our show on demand via podcast. Go to iTunes, type in Sports Business Radio. We're rated in the top 50 business news podcasts. You can also find our show on Audio Boom via the TuneIn Radio and Stitcher apps, and of course at sportsbusinessradio.com. Follow me on Twitter in between shows @SB Radio. Follow us on Instagram at Sports Business Radio. For Brian Griggs, I'm Brian Berger. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you soon right here on Sports Business Radio.
Sports Business Radio with Brian Berger, bringing you the biggest names in sports business.
Without further ado, we all know this gentleman. Let's give David Stern a big round of applause.
Let's welcome the president of the NCAA, Mark Emmert. Give him a hand.
Let's give a big hand to USC alum and co-owner of the Lakers and president of the Lakers, Jeannie Buss.
Thank you for having me. What a nice turnout.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian. It was very, very kind, and I really enjoyed it. Thank you, sir.
Sir Charles, how are you?
I'm doing good, man. How you doing this morning?
Today's guest is Memphis Grizzlies head coach David Fizdale.
You're the man, Barrett.
My guest is tennis icon Chris Evert.
It was very interesting. You asked great questions, so thank you very much, Brian.
Pleased to welcome to the show Kyrie Irving, the number one pick in the 2011 NBA draft.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm happy to be joined by Pete Carroll, the executive VP of football operations and the head football coach of the Seattle Seahawks. Coach, how are you?
Doing good. What's going on?
Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban. Mark, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
Visit sportsbusinessradio.com and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Stay connected to the business side of sports only with Sports Business Radio.